Welcome to the BMT Sustainability Podcast with me, Del Redvers, Sustainability Director at BMT.
And me, Laura Blake. As Head of Sustainability, I've supported BMT's sustainability agenda for 7 years and have dedicated my career to driving sustainable development and responsible business practices.
We have a shared interest in the complexity of shaping a better world. And together, this is our first experience of delivering a podcast.
We're super excited to give this a go and hugely appreciate you being with us on this journey, exploring the diverse and dynamic world of sustainability as we work to deliver purpose-led change.
Our world is full of complex and interconnected challenges, where it isn't always possible to reduce ideas to a single soundbite or statistic, and often where there isn't an objectively right or wrong answer. We want to talk to people across our business to get their ideas on sustainability-related topics, and in doing so, to improve our thinking as a business.
This podcast is our attempt to do just that. In each episode, we will explore different ways of looking at a wide range of challenging topics, prompting us to think critically and stay open to change.
So, thank you for listening, and let's get started.
This is part two of our conversation with Simon Wilmore. So if you haven't done so already, check out part one, where we discuss themes such as the environmental impact of AI and cloud storage. And we also start to unpick some of the hidden costs of our digital habits. So technology is shaping a huge part of our lives, from the alarm clock that goes off in the morning to the devices that we switch off at night. And it's advancing faster than we can really fully grasp. But what does that mean for those with limited access to technology and digital infrastructure? Does this rapid progress deepen the divide between those that have technology and those that don't? Or could it be a catalyst for development? And how do we ensure it's used ethically to drive social and environmental progress? That's what I'd love to explore a little bit further.
For me, the essence of the challenge here is that there is a promise that there is something about the accessibility of technology and data that is fundamentally democratizing. We can get to data sources. We can make better decisions. We can all interrogate data sources now that weren't available to us in the past. And as we've been hearing earlier on, you know, you just need a smart AI to look at your data for you, and it can tell you all sorts of things. And that feels fundamentally democratizing. But I wonder if it's misleading us, not with any intent. I just wonder if we're perhaps all misleading ourselves. And in fact, we're not creating a more democratic or equal system. If I ask you both to name your favourite three philosophers or your favourite three scientists or favourite three mathematicians, it doesn't really matter. And it might be a fun challenge to think about that for a moment. And you can think through and think, oh, what am I interested in? Or who did I like? What, I studied that when I was a student? And you come up with your list, and that's kind of interesting. If I asked you to think of your favourite three female philosophers, the process suddenly changes to, oh, crikey, can I think of three female philosophers? Right. Or if I said, think of your favourite three non-white philosophers. Again, the pressure is a little bit different. The challenge is a bit different. It's harder to answer those questions for those of us in Western societies. And one of the things I find really interesting is that the reason it's hard to find or to answer those questions is that we're exposed to it much less. In my life, I've heard much more about white male scientists, philosophers, engineers, academics, theologians than non-white males. So I've got more examples to draw on. I was taught them at school, I've read about them in books, I see it on the internet. And when we have AI models learning from the totality of data that's out there in the world, aren't they learning a biased view of the world? And as they're generating new content, isn't that new content contributing to a biased view of the world? Because the view and the opinion and the ideas of the global south, for example, are far less represented today in the totality of data that's online than the views of the global north. So doesn't that fundamental, that idea of generating data and smart machines and interrogating this data and just recycling it and building it and enhancing it, doesn't that start from a shaky foundation of inequality that we're just going to keep building on?
I think you're absolutely right. I think inherently the technology isn't biased in itself. It could be built in many, many different ways. I think the training that a lot of the models are built on, though, it is largely built around website content or the originator of those models. And a lot of those are, you know, big Western or American companies. Even if you take a sort of a slightly funny example, which was that when Apple launched its Apple Intelligence service, it would only work in the UK using English US settings. And whilst that's fairly, we sort of laugh at it in the UK, it kind of hints at a much bigger problem that if you're in another part of the world, not only is it you're using Z's instead of S's, but actually it's probably not even written in your language, and it's probably not built around training data that meets with your lived experience, and you're kind of repeating a very kind of Western approach to things. So I go back to I don't think the technology itself is inherently biased one way or the other, but what you train it with and how you what your starting point is is really quite inherently biased today.
I think it is biased, but I also think there's room for optimism here. I think historically there's marginalized communities, whether because of their geography, their gender, or even their socioeconomic status, that have had limited access to education and information. And I think in some societies, girls have had fewer opportunities to read or to receive more formal education. But with the increase of digital platforms and technology that's available, they now have a better chance of improved access to knowledge and perspectives that they may not have encountered otherwise. But at the same time, I do hear what you're saying, Dale. I think we have to be aware that if AI models are trained on biased data and reflect historical inequalities, then they risk reinforcing those biases rather than breaking them down.
I think in my time now, I feel there's a lot more, I don't know, maybe cultural amortization than there has been in the past. And particularly, I think that one of the things I've found in working with generative AI models, particularly ones that involve a degree of web searching, is that you do get sometimes slightly wider views than maybe necessarily what you're asking for. I think that often there's a, if you're looking for information on the internet, that you might always go to the same sources that you've used in the past, and actually the changing landscape of technology maybe does allow you to come into some different views. I think we've all probably seen the documentaries and discussions around how social media is kind of the antithesis of that, whereas actually being designed intentionally to keep the content which is sort of resonating with you in front of you, so it becomes quite deep and quite difficult to break out of. But particularly where I think generative AI probably will get to in the next 5 to 10 years or so, it has much greater opportunity to give you a deeper richness of views and of opinions, and probably does ultimately become maybe a bit more positive than where we are today with that.
I think that's true. And I think it's my lack of understanding that makes me feel slightly anxious about it. But if the representation of views across the world of different sections of society isn't equitable today in terms of the data you can find online, then as generative AI, we were talking earlier on about how we're producing more and more files and iterations, and as that's building off the data we've got, I don't see how those voices that are underrepresented today will catch up. I can see that actually we might slowly broaden into them and get them a bit more. But in terms of the volume of what's out there online, I don't really see how that's going to catch up, because we're generating faster and faster and faster from the, I guess, the voices that are already dominant and the worldviews that are already dominant. So I hear what you're saying, and I can see how we're going to get a little more breadth, but I don't share your confidence, I think, that it's going to change anytime soon. And in fact, if you look back through the evolution of technology so far, it hasn't really closed much of a gap. I think it's opened as many gaps as it's closed, If we look back over the past century and see how the gap between the global north and south has evolved.
So we've dived straight in and discussed some of the challenges to do with technology and AI and how it's potentially learning a biased view of the world. What are some of the other ethical challenges that we foresee around AI?
So I think there's a concern about the black box nature of some of the technology, some of the algorithms. And so we don't know how the processing is happening, or it's not apparent to use the user of the service how technology, the information is being processed. And therefore, you don't know the extent to which you can rely on, or indeed to the extent to which there is genuine accountability for the outcomes of that data processing. And I think a really interesting example was in how facial recognition technology is less reliable for non-white faces, I think is really interesting. And it's hard to challenge or argue that when you can't actually see, you don't understand the data or the algorithms and how they're being used, because it happens inside a sort of in a black box. I think that creates an interesting ethical issue about what does it mean when we can't really, when we don't understand what that algorithm is doing anymore at a societal level. I'm sure a few clever boffins do, but when we don't really understand it. I think another interesting ethical issue is that I come back to the energy supply point, which I came across something that said Google's data center in Finland was 97% renewable powered in 2022. Compare that to less than 20% renewable energy for data centers in Asia because of the lack of availability of clean power in the grid, which means that data centers in Asia make more of a contribution to air pollution problems than they do in Europe, which is another interesting example of inequality. And so it kind of leads me to a thought that in all of this, there are winners and losers, as there are in every kind of technological or social evolution or advancement. There are winners and losers. And what is it we could be doing to try and close that gap between the winners and the losers?
Yeah, so I think investing in the infrastructure across the world should have an equal set of standards. You know, you think from an end user's point of view, yes, you might be buying into Google, but chances are you're using a data center here somewhere in Europe rather than abroad. But actually, does that mean that's right for that company to maybe invest less? I think the answer is no. You know, I think that there is an element to global companies where we ought to be trying to apply effort. How that works at a global scale, I think that's for the politicians to work through. But I think equity, inequality at work, and where is AI? Is it a benefit or a disbenefit or a transformative factor? And where's it going to hit? I think this is, in my mind, in my research I've done on this, this is probably one of the first technologies that probably has quite an impact, whether you're worker management, leadership, you're a technologist or you're not a technologist. I think typically in the past, changes in technology have been seen as ways of reducing maybe some of the working class jobs in an organization. I remember there's a quote I read years ago around the automotive industry that said, when all the automation has gone into the automotive industry over the last 100 years or however long it's been, is it more efficient and employs less people today than it did do previously? And I think most people would say, it must employ a lot less people than it did previously. And even if you account for inflation and GDP growth over time, actually it turns out it doesn't, because actually it turns out that a lot of the jobs that were banging metal into car doors got replaced with electronics engineers and computer scientists and people involved in other parts of the ecosystem and the supply chain in different ways. And so, yes, there have been impacts where automation has transformed jobs. And I think what we're starting to see with generative AI is that it's got packs at kind of two ends of the spectrum. If you've got a low complexity job, like, for instance, I don't know, maybe working in a call center or somewhere, having an AI chatbot to guide you through some of those conversations with a customer when you're new and you don't really know what's going to work, you can really, really see a great way of that a new employee catching up with their co-workers who may have been there for 5 or 10 years, you know, asking those killer questions at the right time, trying to close the deal, trying to get to the end of the form, whatever the call is. Actually, when you're experienced, you're probably not going to rely on it. So what does that do for jobs? Well, maybe it doesn't do anything. Maybe it doesn't stop the number of people you need. But it means now that actually maybe the company will be more inclined over time to maybe recycle its workforce, keep people who haven't been there for as long. And that could have, you know, quite a big, you know, disbenefit for people. But for the ones who are there, they might really get a sense of, you know, enjoyment and a good bit of engagement out of really being able to help people really, really effectively early on. And if you jump to the other end of the kind of complexity job, you know, take a really complex job like a lawyer, like, blimey, you know, I probably do not want to ask an AI for my legal questions about, you know, how am I going to do this? Or how am I not going to do that? And I'd really hope that my lawyer, who may be straight out of university, you know, isn't relying on, you know, some AI that it can't understand and exactly its thought process has gone through. But if you think about that lawyer's, you know, boss, that lawyer, she may be able to sit there thinking, you know, I've got 15 years experience. I can ask it a question and I can assure the output is right, because I understand what's, you know, what's good and bad in an answer. And I think that that will have probably quite a profound impact on maybe more senior, you know, position to people with more experience in more complex jobs and roles. And I think that will, you know, will actually be quite challenging for a lot of people, because maybe some of the middle management jobs, which were good sort of proving grounds to get into doing things where you built up your experience by help, are they still going to exist? Or actually, if my boss is now relying on an AI assistant rather than relying on me to write the presentation, think out this board paper, you know, think through this complex issue, what does that mean for my job? So I think that, you know, as a society and as businesses and organizations and our clients, we're all going to have to work through, you know, what does a kind of a post, you know, AI world mean, when we can all ask questions. We might not know exactly how the answers to the question was formed, but, you know, it's going to impact everybody in one way, shape or another.
Yeah, some really interesting points you drew on there, particularly in an organisational context. And I think it's interesting that you drew on the middle management as an example community. And I think the one thing I can reflect on is that in sustainability, we talk about technology and how it can support us on our net zero roadmap. We talk about our strategy and how we can reduce our environmental impact. But I think Dow would agree with me, the one thing we always come back to at the heart of sustainability challenges is people. Whilst technology is evolving, I don't see a world where businesses don't, you know, rely on people to drive purpose and to drive profit and their bottom line. And ultimately, I don't think there will ever be a replacement for an organization, for example, providing products and looking at customer experience for talking to someone face to face. There's nothing like a facial reaction or in terms of someone how feels and thinks and those sorts of things, that human aspect. And again, we spoke about middle management. I don't see someone being too interested in an organisation if they go through their recruitment process and they're talking to a computer rather than a manager. So I genuinely believe there's not going to be a huge takeover. I think it will happen in parts, like you say, and it helps organisations become more efficient. But I think ultimately we need people to be in businesses and to understand the global challenges that we're faced with, the amount of plastics we see in our ocean today. Yes, you can use technology, but you only have to go for a swim in the sea to see the overall impact of it. And in many ways, what we see on the day-to-day and how we understand those impacts on the ground, it's a lived experience that technology hasn't necessarily gone through.
I think you know, people are the, you know, creativity, you know, creators in all this, you know, with the best tools in the world, you know, an artisan can make, you know, a beautiful piece of, you know, art, and it'll be the same with kind of AI and some of these tools as well, that, you know, it still takes a spark of genius to see, you know, to see something different, to ask the right prompt, to ask the right question, to recognize that, you know, there's an opportunity within a challenge, because otherwise what the kind of AI engines tend to do is sort of tend to normalize down, you know, the lived experiences. You know, yes, you might have an idea, maybe you can test out an idea really quickly, identify some points that maybe you haven't considered, and that can be really, really, really positive, but you're still guiding the AIs on a journey. You know, these things are not completely intelligent, you know, self-thinking kind of entities. It still requires a degree of intelligence on top of it. I think what it really will do now is we'll see it kind of augmenting what we do every day. So yes, yeah, you know, I doubt that in many many jobs, particularly, you know, in BMT, that you're going to be completely relying on AI to do your interview. But I think increasingly you will find that the interviewer may well have, you know, an AI running in the background. Have I missed any key questions? Were there any points between the CV and the interviewer's responses where actually it wasn't clear what the answer was? And being able to run through those sorts of scenarios, you know, in real time, well, I think will actually be better for both sides. You know, it means that actually you as an interviewer, you know, are supported in making the best impact. But also, I think for the interviewee, they probably feel that they've actually, you know, the interviewer has done a very good, thorough job in considering them, particularly picking up on cues for maybe they were a bit nervous. You know, how can I coach them to being less nervous? So things where you might not necessarily have a large amount of personal lived experience in being able to manage. So I think where we have lots of kind of secondary roles like that, I can see real kind of benefit in using some of these AI, you know, technologies to augment what we do.
What we do. I think the biggest frustration, though, and I think I'm hearing you, and it is so complex, and it's so, you know, it can give us so much opportunity, but there's this ethical dimension that Dale's alluded to that sits behind the scene. And the biggest challenge and ethical challenge out of all of this is our human nature to make digital technology seem like everything's going to be done for us. My same frustration when we started this podcast with it being called the cloud. It's this oversimplification of something complex, and behind there being some considerable ethical issues that's going to change our global landscape, hopefully for the better, but for the worse if these problems aren't spoken about.
Well, I think, well, at that point, that oversimplification is really important because actually that's one of the things we want to get, isn't it? That's one of the things we're hoping for as a society from the application of technology, is that at the user interface, at the front end of stuff, things are simplified. Complex information is made much more readily accessible, and we can make better decisions as a result. And that's got great applications in the sustainability space by enabling people to make good decisions and to know what to do. But it's part of a wider societal issue, I think, that actually we're craving simplicity in truth. We're craving simple answers to complex questions. And one of the things that concerns me, particularly about, you know, things like ChatGPT or Gemini, you ask it a question and it throws back some answer at you. And I'm really tempted just to take that and go, yep, I've got that now. I've got a fact on that thing. What are the three most important things I should bear in mind when I'm going to do X, Y, Z? What are the, you know, give me a piece of evidence that substantiates my view on the following thing. And it throws out the stuff and I can take it and it can become truth for me. And yet, you know, in that idea of a black box problem, I don't really know how it got to that truth. I don't know how trustable that truth is, but I'm happy now to take it as a truth. And I think that opens up quite a complex issue for us about what is fact and what is perception and what is just, you know, the massive overwhelming weight of content saying one thing versus actually legitimate scientific evidence might be saying something completely different.
We've seen this challenge before as well in the sustainability space. You use your example, ChatGPT. I can think of a much sort of simple example when electric cars became available. You'd saw, like, on top of the number plate, like a strip of green, which would say, you know, your car is low emissions, but didn't know where, like, that didn't tell you about where the materials came from within the car. And people just went out and bought electric cars. And that was the thing to do. They took the knowledge they were given and said, you know, tick the box, that's the answer, I'll go and buy an electric car.
Like our discussion about things being eco-friendly, to anyone who's listening to the first podcast, it's a simple label you can apply, but it doesn't actually help you understand that the simplification of the complexity can be enabling, but it can also hide the problem if you don't understand the depth of the problem behind it. But Simon, what's your view on the extent to which we should trust the AI answers as truth? Well, I get the point that if it's stuff that we're experts on, we could potentially validate it. But more often than not, I'm asking AI for stuff that I don't think I'm an expert on. And I'm hoping other experts out there will be providing the answers nicely synthesized for me through some clever AI engine. So to what extent should I trust it as truth, and how should I behave as a result?
Yeah, and it's one that comes up, you know, in from a work point of view quite a lot as well. You know, how are we going to quality assure an output where a generative AI of some description has been used in the creation of the content? I think probably my first point in this would be that be mindful of what you're asking it to do and what you're asking it for. You know, I wouldn't ask it a life-changing question and then immediately go with whatever it told me to do. Much in the same way that actually, even if I ask somebody who, you know, supposedly might be an expert in something for an opinion, you know, I'd probably like to try and get a couple of opinions on something important. And I think that from a technology point of view, we need to be, you know, pushing for outcomes to be more explainable than they have been. Yes, in the early days of ChatGPT, now I used it quite a lot, but it's very much a black box machine where you get an answer out and you don't know anything about what the answer is built on, apart from it was trained on a portion of the internet at some point. You know, great, but what portion? You know, and how did that work? And so I tend to now kind of rely on other tools where it uses the language side of the AI to understand what I'm asking, and then maybe then goes to perform some other web-based searches. So maybe goes out the internet and can come back with points of reference. And if it's a really important thing that I really want to understand, then I'll go and follow up on those points of reference. And some of those points may well actually be things misunderstood it. But it's similar again to dealing with a person, I always find it. You know, I think the moment you start treating it like it's a possibly fallible person rather than a machine that's going to be right, you start to get to a slightly healthier, skeptical relationship with it, which is, I think, one of the things I find with people is that they immediately jump to, it's the computer, therefore it must be right. Well, no, actually, just because I found something on the internet doesn't make it fact. Maybe it's from an academic paper, but actually even academic papers recently have been proven in a few cases to be quite erroneous as well. So I think that's my main point is, you know, explainability, you know, is key. But always being a bit skeptical and kind of work your way around a problem to get different viewpoints on it. Because what the technologies are, I find, are really beneficial for at the moment is around rewriting something that I've written, or I want to form an idea about something. How am I going to approach a problem? Asking it for facts and things that are kind of, you know, gospelly true, you know, Tim probably isn't in the greatest way at the moment. I saw a presentation recently, and someone referred to, you know, generative AI as being your 13-year-old teenager at home. You're probably not going to give them the keys to your car, but you know they're okay to, you know, do some low risk things around the house.
I love it. I love it. I one question that I think it links back to the conversation on ethics. What are the issues when AI starts to talk to AI, are coming? Let me give you an example. So if I was going to apply for a job, and I might get some smart help in writing my CV. In fact, you might start before that even, where if I was going to advertise a job, I might go and get an AI-generated job description produced, which I know happens a lot. And then in responding to that job description, I might take that and I might throw it into an AI and say, can you give me a good response to this job description, please, based on the following things, and make up a CV. And then we get an AI-generated CV. And then I submit it to a company who has some sort of smart AI sifting-based tool for the first sift of the CVs to work it out. And how do you make sense of all of that? And my concern, to bring back the bias conversation of earlier, is not that any of the technologies are fire best, but at each stage we can reinforce and reconfirm biases that were already inherent in the original system.
I think there's different takes on that. From a kind of, in some countries that we operate, there are sort of, you know, legal requirements that decisions around employees or future employees' employment, you know, isn't automated. that probably removes, you know, at least some of the risk that that you won't have an AI automatically screen you out. But it can probably still make a recommendation that actually your CV, you know, doesn't meet the requirement and it doesn't work effectively. So I think this is where I think then organizations then, you know, need to take, you know, degree of responsibility for, you know, how do we want to how do we want to operate? How are we going to introduce, you know, human-led safeguards to stop kind of those kind of ill practices creeping in? Of course, if you advertise a job and you have 1,000 applications, then you've probably got a particular challenge there as well. But what else could you do to look at how to make that problem, you know, more manageable? So I think, yeah, there's probably two sides here. Governments could take a kind of a legal approach to make sure that there are some sort of, you know, safeguards that organizations have to follow. But I think even so, as an organization or as a hiring manager, you could take a, you know, kind of a personal view as to how much you're going to rely on a third party giving you a, you know, go-no-go.
Yeah, particularly when we also consider organisations' responsibility when it comes to sustainability, when we're increasingly trying to look at how we increase diversity and inclusion in those processes, I like to think naturally we wouldn't want to use or solely rely on a process like ChatGPT, knowing that, you know, AI and technology is not equal access at the moment to everyone in society. So I'd like to think organizations acknowledge that and take best practice approach when it comes to using AI technology for recruitment and so forth.
I would like to think so. I can see risk in it. In fact, somebody told me the other day in the pub, and Simon reminded us a minute ago that you shouldn't believe everything you read on the internet. You probably shouldn't rely on everything someone tells you in the pub either. But somebody was telling me in the pub the other day how in their firm, they have been involved personally in just very quickly writing a job description using AI, and it's pretty quick and easy, and they posted it and put it out there very fast. I think there's a real risk that if that's based on what good job descriptions look like or what job descriptions look like out there in the world already, that actually how you write a job description that is accessible to less represented sections of society becomes harder and harder and harder. Every time one of those things happen, it kind of reinforces the type of job description that already exists, not the kind of future job description that might exist. So I think it's kind of back to me, it's the black box problem. We don't really understand. I don't understand how to think about these problems, because I don't know how much to trust in it all.
No, but I think that the opportunity, you know, keeping it positive, is that, you know, if you recognise that there's a risk of that, asking the AI to review my job description, is that accessible? Have I used gender neutral language? Have I made this, you know, appropriate to the widest possible audience? And how can I improve it? Those are all questions which, if I was left to write a job description on a Friday afternoon, I'm probably doing it in a rush. I might know that I need to do all those things, but actually my mental effort is going to go into getting it done as, you know, as fast as I can do. Whereas, you know, with AI now, I can generate the job description in literally a few seconds, maybe taking the business case I used to write for the job, or, you know, something, some other role profile that was created during the process. And then I can then actually spend my time, you know, rather than spending 90% of my time creating the content and 10% reviewing it, I could now spend 10% creating the content, yeah, and maybe 90% reviewing, and actually worry about those other points that I wouldn't have necessarily thought before, because I haven't tried it. But I bet if you ask the AI to review a job description and think about all those things that you're worried about, I bet it will give you a far better response than I would be able to come up with myself.
Yeah. And I think the one point you touched on there is like probably the biggest thing that's concerning me, back to the beginning as well, what keeps you up at night is human nature and convenience. And like you said, ultimately, if someone's in a rush, they're going to go back to ChatGPT and write something straight in and sort of spruce up at the end.
I think that's a great example. Most of these ethical questions that we're talking about today and the challenges, they're fundamentally linked to human nature. You're absolutely right. But they're also, they're important things for us to think about, but they're also not necessarily things that we can particularly engage with as individuals on a regular basis. Because they are quite complicated to know how algorithms work and what they do and what they include and what they don't include. what do we feel optimistic about? What are we excited about in terms of the application of artificial intelligence to sustainability?
I think choice and understanding is the absolute, probably the most powerful, you know, bit of what I can see in the next, you know, the next kind of 5 years or so. I think connecting people in a way where you don't maybe have to have an in-depth understanding about a topic to start to understand and explore a topic is, you know, it's really powerful from a kind of an equality perspective, but also being able to start to explore different aspects of complicated issues like sustainability, like what we talked about, shopping bags, you know, which one, you know, what's the pros and cons for doing to choosing, you know, three plastic throwaway bags over a bag for life? And those were all questions which a few years ago it would have been really, really hard for me to have formed an opinion on. To be honest, it's probably so hard I just would have given up and gone, well, the government wants me to pay 10p for that and I pay 50p for one that's going to last forever. Chances are I'll probably throw it away at some point anyway. I'll just go with the path of least resistance. And I think that technology continues to be a route for us, though, to go through those, maybe those difficult, challenging things, which maybe were too difficult to work through, you know, personally, in an easier way, making it more accessible to make, you know, better informed decisions. But we can't over rely on it. We need to be critical. We need to think about, you know, the things that kind of, you know, make us unique as a species, and creativity and critical thinking around issues. But also giving ourselves a bit of time back to, you know, to focus on what we want to. You know, if we can automate and remove out some of the drudgery of aspects of particularly kind of office life, you know, maybe it's the daily commute, maybe it's writing those job descriptions. So everyone's got a different opinion on kind of what they enjoy and what they don't enjoy. And I think technology ultimately gives us choices to do what we prefer to do best.
Yeah, I think for me it stems from a similar point that Simon mentioned about sort of getting to answers quicker. I think we will get to a world where we can move towards renewables and use technologies like quantum computing that I don't understand, but understand that it's going to make things more efficient. If we can move to that space where things become less intensive on the environment in terms of materials and energy usage, hopefully it will support other societies get to answers quicker and bring people out of poverty much quicker than we're seeing today in terms of education, renewable energy, access to food and resources and those sorts of things, just because our thinking will be developing that much quicker. So, you know, the repercussions of all of this, I can see being really positive for the long term in terms of those communities.
So that opens up opportunities that weren't there before,
yeah,
right? Which is yeah, really exactly. Exciting. I feel the same. I love both your answers. I think the ability to do things we couldn't possibly dream of doing before is really exciting. Whether that's more effective remote monitoring and data gathering to be better informed, whether it's better predictive modeling for things like climate risk, I think it is already being absolutely transformative there. I was struck recently by the Virtual Singapore project, which you've probably come across, but it's the digital twin of a whole country, and using that to create, to enable better urban planning, environmental, healthcare, and disaster response decision making, by being able to do something that we simply couldn't have done, the world simply couldn't have delivered, you know, 20 years ago, and where that sort of technology will take us in the future, I think there's a lot to be excited about. So what should we do with all of this stuff? We've had a good conversation about it.
Yeah.
What can we actually do?
Yeah, I think we have to think about it as individuals. It's not just people like Simon, who we have today, whose responsibility it is to look at this stuff and do something about it. At BMT, most of us own a mobile phone. I think all of us own a mobile phone. All of us have access to a computer. All of us are storing data. So there's something at our disposal that we can all do. Simon, what would your recommendation be to someone at an individual level working at BMT? What's the best thing they can support in improving their approach to digital technology?
Yeah, so I think if we start off, you know, right at the beginning, when we start off talking about storage, and whilst, you know, it might feel like a very, very minor thing. Just think about what have you got and what if you're keeping hold of. You know, that kind of that decluttering that you do at home occasionally, where you go around, empty out your drawers, think about what's in your OneDrive, think about what's in your Teams environments as well. And if you don't need it, do you need 15 versions of the same document? Yeah, version 1, version 2, version 2 with Laura's comments, version 2 with Dell's comments on Laura's comments, the 3 emails that we sent each other, you know, all of those attachments on. You know, whilst it all seems really, really minor, because we don't get rid of anything, it lasts forever and it all has a cost. And it then means that things like your use of AI in the future is going to be starting to try and use all this kind of redundant or old versions of stuff. So I think the first thing would be, you know, delete the stuff you don't need. Get rid of the things you don't need anymore. But if you're going to share links. We don't have to, you know, send attachments to each other all the time as well, because that, at an individual level, just creates a massive amount of clutter. So number one is, I just think, always try and be mindful. Reduce your kind of online footprint, you know, as much as you can do. Try not to have 50 pictures of your cat. But also, if you're going to use AI, which we all will, you know, increasingly use as well, just, you know, be mindful and sort of critical of the answers it's giving you. You know, think about what you're asking it to do. Think about how it's responding to you and how you would check that if that was somebody telling you that maybe in the pub or somebody you didn't know from work as well. You know, treat it like a coworker, not some sort of infallible, amazing, you know, omnipotent, you know, piece of technology that knows the answer to everything and is going to give you a perfect answer. Just treat it like it's another person rather than something different.
Yeah, thank you so much. Dell, what about yourself? What's the individual message that you would send to our listeners?
Oh, I think it's the same kind of thing I always say, Laura, which is be curious. What we've discovered today, what I've learned today is this is a really complicated topic, and in our wide-ranging conversation, I feel we barely scratched the surface of it, and yet it's got me thinking about a lot of different things. And you can't always know the right thing to do and the right answer, but you can always be curious and want to try and find out more and want to understand. So I think we should certainly not automatically, as Simon said, trust everything that AI engines produce for us. We clearly have a responsibility to take care of our own data in terms of not leaving a large digital footprint that has an environmental impact, and you have to understand that. We have a responsibility not to try and overprocess things, so we create models that are more complex than we need them to be, or ask questions that we don't need answers to, knowing that all of that has an impact. And we need to be mindful of the fact that this is just a tool. We're just talking about a set of tools, really, which don't change human nature. They may exacerbate, they may enhance, they may highlight certain aspects of human nature for good or for ill, but fundamentally it's just a tool set and human nature remains the same. And that's what we're always the most curious about.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. It's about asking the right questions. So when someone is submitting a job application, you know, think through what you want to say. Don't rely solely on ChatGPT. When someone's talking to you about the cloud, question what the cloud is. Is it really a cloud, or is it a digital dungeon of data stored somewhere else that we need to think about? Or when you're taking photos, do you really need that extra photograph? And it's all those sorts of questions that we have to ask.
I love that, Laura. Is that your phrase, the digital dungeon? Have you just come up with that?
I do think that we should use a different term for the cloud, personally.
The digital dungeon. Love it.
Is that okay, Simon?
No. Where's Simon? Oh, he's down in the digital dungeon.
What word would you use?
I always like to just think of the cloud as someone else's computer. So it's all it is. There's nothing more complicated than that. You know, it's not magical. You know, it's not scary. It is just someone else's computer.
Computer down in the digital dungeon. My little troll that turns the handle.
Possibly.
Exactly.
Possibly.
On that note, thank you so much for joining us, Simon. Hope that you've enjoyed exploring this topic as much as we have. And thanks so much, Dow, as always.
Yeah, thank you, Laura. Thank you, Simon. It was brilliant to explore with you and have access to your knowledge. So thank you for bringing insight to us. It's really helped.
No, thank you very much.
Until next time, let's keep questioning and striving for more honest impact.